The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 251 for Monday, March 22nd, 2010.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 251. I am Dave Hamilton, here from Durham, New Hampshire. Yes, I'm home. I made it home from my South by Southwest travels. And we're here on the other end of the Skype line, as always.
John F. Ron here, Fairfield, Connecticut. And let us not forget, on the other end.
Yeah, I'm here with Dave.
Yay.
Woo-hoo. All right. That's like two shows in a row. Well, almost two shows in a row.
Two studio recorded shows in a row. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So we are in the studio. I was just mentioning to the guys that we have had we recorded a very long pre-show today. We had a great political debate, and then, of course, we talked through the agenda very, very briefly. But we had absolutely no FireWire audio issues to speak of during the pre-show, so we'll get them all now.
Nice. You just cursed it.
Yep. That's right. That's right. I know the solution here, and it is to buy a USB audio interface, even though on paper that's not the right answer. It clearly is in the Mac audio world, because despite the fact that FireWire is audio of FireWire is Apple's standard, they simply have not been able to make it work reliably with the Mac. I don't know, it's crazy, but anyway, we've all heard enough about that.
Yes,
shall we let's dive right into the questions. I know we've got all kinds of things. You got some tips. I probably have a couple more things from South by Southwest to share, but let's dive right in and answer Thomas's question. Thomas writes, "Hello, Dave and John. My airport, for some reason, will change from my network to another unlocked network by itself, usually after I put it to sleep and I wake up in the morning. When I wake up, it will be on another network. It just started doing this itself a few days ago. How do I fix it?" All right, John, I think you're ready on this one.
I think I got it. So where I would look is I would go to System Preferences, Network, you're going to have your airport selected, and then there'll be an advanced button. So you want to click on that advanced button. Now I'm going to bet this is what's happening. If you look on the leftmost tab in that dialogue, it'll be called airport. And then there's going to be a list of preferred networks. I'm going to wager that the...
How much? Come on. How much are you going to wager?
Steak dinner, baby.
Steak dinner. Good. I'm eating.
I'm going to guess that the remember networks this computer has joined is checked. I would uncheck that. And I'm also going to bet that in preferred networks, there's going to be that errant base station that you don't like. So here's what I would suggest. I would uncheck remember networks this computer has joined. I would whack everything in the preferred networks. And then I would only add your network. And because I think what's happening is that for some reason it's got that one every now and then you connect to. I'm guessing that's towards the top, if not on the top of the list, for whatever reason. I guess that these get added in the order they've been joined.
Yep. So
that's my guess. Now I've had something happening, Dave, which I can't quite figure out yet, and I'm still diagnosing it. Every once in a blue moon, when I turn on my machine and I have my primary airport base at the very top of that list, every once in a great while, it'll come up and not find it. And it will not connect to anything that's a backup. And I'm trying to figure if it's interference or what's going on here. It's inconclusive, but I have had one or two cases where my machine does not connect. And I know the base is there because, I mean, there are other devices in my house that connect to that, and it is available. So if I type it in manually, then it connects just fine. So I don't know why I'm not...
All right.
Why that's happening.
I have comments on your issue. I also have comments on Thomas's. So I'll start with Thomas. So yeah, as you said, John, if you go into the airport section of the network section of System Preferences, you will see that list of those base stations or airport networks to which it has connected. And that list is prioritized. So whatever is at the top of that list is the base station to which it will connect. You can drag things around in that list to reorder them so that you could put, say, your list. Let's say you did want to leave your neighbor's network out there, or let's say your neighbor's network is called something very common like Linksys, And you know that when you go to your buddy's house, he's got a network named Linksys. So you don't want to remove it from the list. You just want to make sure your network is prioritized over that one. So you could leave it out there and move it up to the move yours up to the top. And in theory, it should pick that network over all others, assuming it sees it. Now, to your issue here, John, I've seen something like this here. My Airport Extreme that I have over at the house has been it's been a little flaky. And sometimes, even though there are other devices connected to it, it won't let new devices connect without me actually cycling power on the Airport Extreme itself. Mm-hmm. I don't know why this happens. I think I'd seen it before, but it certainly seemed to the frequency of it increased after my daughter got her Mini 10V, which does connect to that base station. So I don't know if there's something about, you know, the wireless circuit in that that's doing something a little funky, but I'm not sure what exactly it is, but yeah, there's something weird out there. Pete, you said you've got something to add.
Well, I was just going to add, you know, John said whack the networks, and you kind of covered it, saying you may want to leave them. As a road warrior, there are two or three networks that I have that have passwords and WPA stuff, and that's all in there, and I like to leave that so I can get in there. So don't just willy-nilly whack it. You probably know that anyway, but it's just worth mentioning that.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the only thing that gets me in my case is that if I go, if I go to the airport menu and say other or do it manually,
it works.
Then it connects. So maybe it just, maybe there's a resource that's taken up, and if I try to acquire it again.
I'm going to have to try that the next time, I can't connect to the network in the house on the Airport Extreme. I'm going to have to try just typing it in manually and see if that works before I go and bother to reboot the machine or reboot the router. Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. All right. On to Brad. Brad says, I've been having an interesting issue after upgrading to Snow Leopard on my MacBook Pro. Was hoping you could help enlighten me. Occasionally after booting up my Mac, say one in 10 times, I find that my menu bar fails to appear on the screen. Other times, the icons in the menu bar, such as Spotlight and Battery Life, will appear, but there will be no menu bar border. Usually opening any application will spring the menu bar back onto the screen, but I've had a few occurrences where I had to reboot the machine to correct the problem. It's a puzzling issue, and I have no idea where to even begin. And he sent us a picture of his desktop, which, of course, showed exactly what he just described. All right, John, let's head down this path. I've got a couple of ideas, and more so even just as we're kind of going through this again. But let's go with the obvious stuff first. So
where I would start, now I have... my menu bar, at least my MacBook Pro, is chock full of not only Apple things like the clock and Spotlight, battery, airport, time machine, you know, mobile me, but I also have several third-party things like menu meters, weather bug. I have that up there, iFi, a few other things. The only one I've noticed that's sometimes problematic is weather bug sometimes. So when it starts up, it includes a little item that shows the temperature, and if you click on it, you can get more information. And I've gotten on occasion crash reports from that. And a lot of times when that happens, I sometimes, though not always, will see corruption in my menu bar. So what I would suggest is you may want to try disabling either some of the Apple or maybe some of the third party things that appear up in your menu bar and see if this problem goes away. You can, of course, look in the console, but sometimes the console may get full. So another place you can look to see if anything up there is misbehaving is if you go to /library/logs/crash reporter is typically where these crash reports live. And if you see anything in there that corresponds to something that, you know, is also in the menu bar, that would be my first candidate for, diagnosing this and perhaps removing that and see if the problem goes away. So those are my two cents.
All right. I'm curious, John, have you seen crash reporter logs named after menu bar items before, or are you just speculating that it might appear there?
Well, I have seen one from Weatherbug.
Okay, but was
which
it Weatherbug
place itself?
Weatherbug the app or Weatherbug? Oh, because Weatherbug is a background app. It's not really a menu bar item like the old days. I get it. Okay. So there are two types of things that can appear as items in your menu bar. One is a background app that's running and puts itself in the menu bar. And that, I think you're right, John, would appear as a crash log item. The other thing is, and these are, I think support for them is deprecated in, I think it was even deprecated in Leopard, but certainly in Snow Leopard, where you get a true menu bar item like Apple with their volume widget and all that other stuff. And those are all running inside of system UI server. And I think also the apps that are running somehow hook into system UI server. So if you're seeing crashes from system UI server, that would also indicate a menu bar issue. The system UI server pref list or P list preference, it's a plist file, but it's where the preferences are stored, is in your home folder, library preferences, and then com.apple.systemuiserver.plist. Again, you've got to open this up with a plist editor or text wrangler or BB editor, something that can see this file. And in there you can edit and pull out items that are going to appear, or if you suspect corruption, you could just delete that file and reboot the machine, and then system UI server will start and create a new preference file. So that would be another way to do it. But the interesting thing I noticed as we were reading this through this, John, is he says that it's not just the icons in the menu bar that don't appear, but it's the menu bar itself. And in fact, sometimes the icons appear, but not the menu bar. And really, that's not system UI server at all. That is the application or the framework that the application calls upon to draw the menu bar. And when he said that he switches from, he opens up an app and the menu bar appears and then everything's okay, that almost leads me to think that there's something wrong with the Finder, because the Finder would be the first app to load and it would be the thing to initially draw a menu bar on the screen. But of course, when you switch to other apps, you're using menu bar from those apps instead. So I wonder if trashing the Finder's preferences here would be the would be a place to start, because if the icons are appearing but there's no menu bar behind them, to me that's a different issue. It's interesting. There's no magic answer here, but I think perhaps trashing the Finder prefs and rebooting, mm-hmm. and that's going to be in let's see, home, library, preferences, and then where, John, do you know it off the top of your head? Okay, great. Perfect. I think it's com.apple.finder.plist, and that's exactly what it is. Yeah. So trash that file and reboot. Yeah.
I was looking somewhere else to close this out. That in addition, there is another folder within logs called diagnostic reports. And this actually kind of validates what you were saying, Dave, is that I see reports in here. I see some system UI server ones. I also see some Finder ones. I see battery health monitor. I see hardware growler. I see some things that are, none of these, except for the system UI server stuff,
yep,
could potentially be menu related. But actually that whole log folder,
just read everything there.
Yeah, well, not everything. Well, I've noticed this too. I've noticed in the console, apparently in the background, every now and then these get shipped off to Apple.
Yeah,
I've seen this in the log where it's like, oh, okay, I took the, and I think it eventually purges old ones there.
It should. The weekly script, I think, that runs once a week should purge the older ones. Yeah.
But I noticed that one day using the program both you and I love, Dave. Little snitch. One day I noticed it's like, hey, this crash reporter or something wants to go out on the network to Apple. And I'm like, it does. I'm like, well, okay, I guess that's all right.
Huh.
But I guess this is how Apple, secretly or not so secretly collects information about why things on your Mac crash, and hopefully they can make it better.
Cool. I don't love Little Snitch at all, but what?
I know you despise it.
I do. I just find that it trains most people to ignore and dismiss warning messages. And that's my big concern with it.
I know. But just found it useful to even know that this was happening, because otherwise, unless I poured through the console, I would never know that the OS was doing this on my behalf.
Right. But what I do love is the fact that we have a sponsor. Our first sponsor of the show here makes our job very easy, because it's a product that I absolutely love to use. And that is Audio Engine with their A2 desktop speakers. These are self-powered. Two speakers or two enclosures with each two speakers in them. So four total speakers, a tweeter and a woofer in each one. They're small in that they're, maybe 4 inches tall. They sit nicely on the desk. There's a cable that runs between them that's plenty long, so you can spread them out to get a nice stereo field. They plug directly into your Mac's audio output port, and then they've got a AC plug that goes into the wall to power the amplifier that's inside them. And the sound that they deliver, these speakers were engineered to deliver audio coming from a computer, and it is such a full sound. We use them over in the house, and I've got it fills our study and our kitchen really, really nicely. They've got a nice low end. Even though they're a very small speaker, they're low end. They've got a bass port on them that obviously has been carefully tuned. And for $199, you can get them in either white or black. But here's the best part is using coupon code MGG10, T-E-N. So MGG10, all caps, you save 10%. So you can get them for about $180. They do have what they call a free audition, which is you get them home and for 30 days you can test them out. And if you don't like them, they'll refund your entire purchase price when you send them back. So these are the Audio Engine A2s from AudioEngineUSA.com. If you're in the market for speakers, or even if you're the kind of person who uses your built-in speakers to your iMac to listen to music, consider, you know, it's a relatively inexpensive upgrade, and your ears will thank you. So AudioEngineUSA.com. Now we're moving on to another question that actually sparked a very interesting discussion in our pre-show that we kind of put on hold to pick up here. Thomas, I think it's a different Thomas, but Thomas writes, I was reading at Apple and looking at the specs on the iPad, it seems like you can't use this on an airplane because it says it has to operate at an altitude of 10,000 feet or less. And Thomas, you are right in that the specs say the maximum operating altitude is 10,000 feet. However, if you go to the page for the MacBook Pro or the page for the iPhone or the iPod or anything else, it says exactly the same thing. So, John, you and I both understand this enough to talk reasonably intelligently about it. But the good news is we have our own resident altitude expert here in Pilot Pete. So the obvious first question here, Pete, that I think you're going to help us answer is, I'm pretty sure what they're talking about here is effective altitude in terms of air pressure and not just some random, determinant for how high up you are from sea level.
I'd agree with that. And in addition, I don't think they're just doing it to keep the pilots from using the cockpit and going past their destination. I make light of that, I'll stay away from that.
Okay.
I have my own opinions on that, but that's a whole nother show in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
The thing to remember is it probably would be deleterious to use the LCD display above 10,000 feet, knowing what little I know about how the LCD works. That being said, when you're in an aircraft, a pressurized modern jetliner, it is going to be pressurized on average at about 8.5 PSI differential. So when you
what's
say
a, what's that mean? Yeah.
But yeah. Pounds per square inch. Okay. And when I'm talking about that, people think the airplane is pressurized. It goes below sea level or something. It doesn't. Your aircraft internal altitude is about 8.5 pounds per square inch more pressure inside than outside the cabin. What does that translate to? Well, at 43,000 feet, 8.5 PSI translates to roughly 8,000 feet internal. So you're at 8,000 feet as if you were on a mountainside.
It's as though you climbed up a mountain to 8,000 feet.
Exactly.
You have the same amount of pressure in the air in the airplane that you would have outside.
Right. And the reason we have that pressure is so that the oxygen that touches your lungs is actually forced across the membrane and into the blood cell and then carried throughout your body.
Keep you conscious.
Exactly, keeps you alive, you know.
Yeah.
Getting air onto the blood that goes into the brain is highly important.
Through your pilot training, they impress that upon you.
They do. What was that movie? The Richard Gere one. Can't believe Officer and a Gentleman.
Yeah.
Where they show that and they're in the pressure chamber. What they're doing is that they're in there. They're not pressurizing it. They're sucking the air out of that thing. So they're bringing them up in altitude, and then they have to take their oxygen mask off, and they do. You play patty cake, you count cards, you do all those kinds of things, and you quickly see the symptoms of hypoxia And no, so that you know what it feels like when you start losing coordination and your ability to think goes into slow motion and everything around you literally time shifts on, as far as your brain is concerned. It gets ugly early, and that's why they do it, so that you have that symptom and can get on oxygen and save your own life. Because, you know, particularly in the military, you've got a lot of single seat aircraft. And you need to recognize there's no one else there looking out for you.
Is right. Yeah. Okay, so we are going up. Whenever we take our devices, this is something that people should be aware of. But in theory, Apple has thought about this long before the product ever makes it to market, and they realize that that they need to design their devices to be used in commercial aircraft at reasonable cruising altitudes.
Right, exactly. And 10,000 feet gives you plenty of margin. For the most part, I forget exactly what the number is, somewhere around 14,000 feet cabin altitude. If the pilot doesn't reach up and hit the switch, the oxygen masks will drop down automatically.
Okay.
So if you get they talk about the mask coming down. If you get a rapid decompression and the altitude in the aircraft goes up, they don't even have to reach the switch. There's a pressure sensor in there that'll throw the switch automatically and let the oxygen mask come down.
Got it.
So. But you will never see, as a passenger, assuming everything is normal, you will almost never see anything probably above 6,500, maybe 7,000 feet pressure altitude if you got one of those little geeky watches with the altimeter on it.
Okay. All right. That was my question was, what's a reasonable, because it's 43,000 feet. That's real high.
That's above what most airliners do. There are a few.
For most planes, that it starts to approach that, what's that called? The triangle,
L over D max, your ability, the air is getting too thin up there for the engines and the wings to operate properly.
Yeah, there's a name for that, right? It's a geeky name. It's like the death pyramid or the death triangle or something like that.
Well, we had the death equation in the Harrier, but that was something different. Yeah, that has to do with your airspeed and your yaw and your angle of attack. It has to do with your angle of attack. I mean, the wing has to create a higher angle through the air to develop more lift, and the higher you get, the thinner the air, the harder it has to work.
At some point,
and then
the engine can't do it.
Reaching Mach maximum, and you start getting, the airplane just can't go any faster without starting to rip things off of it, and bad things happen.
Right.
So you stay away from that regime.
Say, John, you have a question here for Pete?
Well, one question here, Pete. Now, let me speculate here, because I see in the specs here, they also say maximum shipping altitude, 35,000 feet. Let me take a wild guess here, because based on what I know, most commercial large airliners usually... that's about as high as they go, or maybe a little less than, or at least when they announce it, it's 30 something thousand feet. Are cargo holds pressurized or not as
absolutely?
They are.
Cargo, the FedEx and UPS and DHL, all of those airplanes are flying. The only thing different is that they've taken the seats of the overhead out and they've put roller mat down in order to expedite onload and offload. But the entire aircraft is completely pressurized.
Altitude spec'd at 35,000.
I don't know. That's interesting. That's an interesting question. But
I didn't know they're pressurized. Well,
I guess what they're saying there, if you're off, don't operate it. If you have rapid decompression, don't operate your device. But
cool.
Yeah, I can't imagine why it would be. No, even our lower bellies are all pressurized. Okay. That's why you can ship dogs and cats and stuff down there.
Right. So, or people even.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting, John, is I did run into an issue with this where I had, I think it was my fifth generation iPod, and it worked fine. And then I went up in the air and I look at the thing and it's got the dead hard drive icon on it. And I thought, oh, man, and I was going on vacation. It was terrible. It's like, I really wanted to use this thing while I was on vacation, and now it just doesn't work. This sucks. And so, whatever, I put it in a bag and then we got to wherever we were going, and let me take a look at this. I didn't have a laptop with me, so I couldn't even restore to it. It was one of those things. I look at it, and it worked fine. I thought, oh, thank goodness. And then on the way back, the same thing happened in the air. Dead hard drive icon. All right, what's going on? And so what I realized was that the drive in the iPod was not up to spec and did not function at whatever the effective altitude was. When I was up at 30,000 feet. And so I called Apple and they said it was still in warranty. And they said, sure, no problem. And I sent it in and they, fixed it and sent it back. And then I get on a plane and a couple months later, and I go up, and sure enough, it doesn't work again. It's like, you know, so I knew this time what was going on. And so I called Apple when I got home and I said, listen, you know, and they're like, oh yeah, well, we tested it here. You know, they looked in the notes. We tested it here and we found that the drive worked fine.
So we sent it back to you.
So we sent it back to you. Man. And here was the kicker. It had been, I was now out of warranty and it had been, you know, slightly more than 90 days since the last repair. So they're like, oh, sorry, you're out of the repair window. And I said, wait a minute. You know, I can't test the thing unless I'm in an airplane. And you people, you know, the symptoms are exactly the same. So they you know, they did get that waived and they said, well, we're just going to replace the drive, even though we can't confirm. Like, no, you can confirm. You just have to get your butt on a plane with your screws and your screwdrivers and your test gear. And you can fix this thing. And you know what? Why don't you fly the plane straight back to me? You can hand deliver it yourself.
I guess they
fixed.
Don't offer that troubleshooting service at altitude.
So,
or a pressure chamber.
Yeah, that's right. So it, you know, it is possible that this can happen. And if you see any weird symptoms with your devices, be it your computer or your iPod or anything while you're on a plane, know that there could be some part of that device that's not up to spec. And most often it's going to be the hard drive because that is the moving part, of choice in most of these devices, but it's definitely, and we saw it with one of, I think with Lisa's, with one of her iPods too, I think we saw the same thing. So it's definitely, you know, worth being aware of that, you know, pressure can render different components useless in different ways. So, or lack of pressure or too much pressure, but hopefully you don't experience too much pressure.
Interesting. So that's why everybody needs an SSD because, because I've seen that on a lot of drives is, no, there's like a little membrane that I guess is used to balance the pressure between the inside and the outside of the drive. And of course, SSDs, right. I don't believe, well, unless they're under extreme pressure, right. They're going to suffer from that thing.
Right, so. Right.
Anyways.
All right. I want to, let's do Eric next. This was very interesting what we have going on here. It's a good question. Eric says, I was wondering if you knew of an app to do the following. I'm currently looking to buy a phone on Craigslist. What I would like is an app that could search through the listings and send me email alerts when an ad meets my criteria, i.e. price, description, location, etc. I know Craigslist can generate an RSS feed of your search. So if there is no standalone app to search Craigslist, then there must be an app that can just send me email alerts every time a new post comes up in the RSS feed. With that, there's a couple of different options here. My first instinct was, okay, yeah, RSS is the way to go. Now we just need to find something. And my gut said, well, Growl is real good at this. And you can link NetNewsWire and Growl, NetNewsWire being an RSS reader application, and Growl, and have that work. The other thing you can do is Google will do Google alerts based on an RSS feed. And there was I didn't put the link here in the show notes. I'm going to have to find it again. There was a little bit of a hack of syncing up a Google Reader folder with a Google Alerts thing and having an email generated. But we'll find that. I'll find that URL, John, and I'll give it to you for the show notes. But I think the NetNewsWire Growl thing would be best, except it requires your computer to be on and scouring this, scouring this. So if you want an email generated when you're away from your computer, you're going to need to use, and your computer's off, then you're going to need to find a third party service. And I think there's a kind of a workaround way to do it with Google RSS reader. So, and then John, you found something else, or you had another idea.
Well, just another idea, and it seemed to work. I don't think it's quite what he's looking for, but since I got this love fest going on with Mail, I noticed that when you install Mail, it defaults to Apple RSS information feed. Well, you could say it's propaganda, and that gets updated every now and then. So Mail, Apple Mail, definitely has the capability to consume RSS feeds. And then I thought, well, you know, they also got this thing called smart mailboxes, which I haven't looked at a lot yet. But this, I think, is credit to the ease of use. At least I was able to figure it out. So I'm like, you know, let me make a smart mailbox. And so I made a smart mailbox. And the first condition, I'm like, okay, well, let's say message type is RSS article. And then I added another condition. And I said message contains, and in this case, I put iPad. Well, I finished that, created the smart mailbox. And voila, the smart mailbox appeared. And it had exactly one message, which was the message from Apple PR that was talking about the iPad. So consider a smart mailbox. I mean, it doesn't, it's not necessarily an email, but it does show up in a smart folder in Mail App. So
that's
maybe
true.
It'll work for you.
Yeah, that's right. If the goal is to have it show up in Mail App, then you're good to go. And, you know, here's the other thing. You could use an app like DocStar, which is a mail add-on, D-O-C-K-S-T-A-R. And what it lets you do is have and customize the badges that appear on the mail doc icon, as well as putting badges in your menu bar showing the number of unread messages in whatever folder or folders you want. And you can do five of them. And if you have all five lit up at once, it makes a star. And I think that's why they call it Doc Star. But you could certainly, you know, say, okay, I'm going to attach a star or a doc, you know, a doc badge to that smart mailbox. And now you could have a big, you know, yellow icon show up. You can customize the color and the location and the size and all that stuff. So, you know, mail could badge itself in a very apparent way, or you can have it badge the menu bar or both in a very apparent way. So if you're looking to have that show up when you're at your computer, that's the workaround. I like that. That's good. Cool. All right. Time for Ivan here, huh, John? We talked in the last show. We were talking about various time machine issues, and in passing, I made the comment that you could not use without a hack. You could not use AirDisk, that being a disk attached to an Airport Extreme, as a time machine destination. And here's what Ivan says.
Hey, John and Dave, this is Ivan from West Palm Beach, Florida. I think it's episode 250. You guys are talking about Airport Extreme backing up to an AirDisk, external hard drive. I don't have my Airport Extreme hacked in any way, or Samba hacked in any which way. And I have my Snow Leopard server backing up via Time Machine to an Airport Extreme with an external hard drive, and it's been working just fine, and I have no hacks whatsoever. Not sure if you guys have tried this recently, but it works for me. All right, you can cut me off. Thanks.
Cool. Okay. So this is interesting. The hack, it is possible. I want to state out of the gate here. I do not use an air disk hanging off of an Airport Extreme as my time machine backup. So I only live on that which I read elsewhere, at least in terms of this. But it is possible that now works. However, the hack is not done to the Airport Extreme. The hack is done to the Mac in question, and it really is a hack that says it's one of those, you know, we talked about it on I think our most recent premium show, John, the whole concept of typing one line default settings into the terminal. And it's one of those. It's a default setting that essentially says, go ahead and let Time Machine use unsupported disks. And then this magically appears.
Right.
So and I actually asked on Twitter this morning to see if there was perhaps some update that I didn't know about, you know, that we hadn't heard about or whatever, John, that made this change in the OS to do that. But I haven't really gotten any answers, although some people have said, yeah, it works fine. And I don't think I have it hacked, but it's hard to remember, you know. So, Pete, now you have an Airport Extreme at your house.
I do. And I have an air disk hanging off it. And okay. I use that as my backup for my Time Machine.
Okay.
For my MacBook Pro, which I use the terminal command to use unsupported drives.
Okay. Now, do you have, just to be sure, do you have the latest version of the firmware on your Airport Extreme as well?
99% sure. As of a week and a half ago, I did.
Okay. I'm certain you did, because when we launched Airport Utility, it would have told us you didn't.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, it comes up. That's right. So, about a week and a half ago, I was putzing with that, and I checked to make sure it was updated, and it was. So, and that being said, now I also have the iMac that my wife is running, and we just tried to, I've never set up Time Machine. We just tried to set it up, and it does not recognize that drive, and it's sitting on the network. So,
okay.
And we were in there. In fact, I'm still on it. I'm still VPN'd into my home network right now.
That's a good
thing. And, it just isn't recognizing the drive.
It doesn't
there.
Show up. So, okay. All right. So the one thing is that, as you noticed, Pete, while Ivan's comment was playing, is that Ivan's using Snow Leopard server, And it's possible, being that this is a hack that you make to the OS, it's possible that Snow Leopard server has a different level of tolerance for what it's willing to see as a time machine drive. If anybody has any more details on this, be sure to let us know, and we'll be happy to share them here and aggregate things. But as far as I know, it is still not supported by Apple. So
that being said, maybe you could put that hack in the show notes again. That's a nice one.
Oh, that's a good answer. Yeah, thanks, Pete. That's a good idea. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Because I couldn't find it right now if I wanted to, and I sure would like to. So I can get that iMac going.
Okay. And what am I doing here? I'm trying to find all sorts of various different things. I think it's time for a second sponsor, John. And that sponsor is GoTo Assist Express. The idea is simple. Pete, it's very interesting. You are talking about how you had to connect to your home machine. Now, right. In order to connect to, you've got screen sharing turned on, right, on your home machine. In order to do that, you either would have had to use Back to My Mac, which we know is very sort of flaky.
Flashy, yeah.
Yeah. Or, and you have to have an Apple router for that. Otherwise it doesn't work. Or, you had to do what you did, which is you already have a VPN server set up at home. You VPN'd in, and then we had to use Apple's special way of waking up that computer. And then now, boom, we're good to go. GoTo Assist makes this process much, much simpler. What it does is you go into your GoTo Assist account as the consultant or the controller, and you generate a new support session, and then you either give that URL, it gives you a URL. You can either email that URL automatically to the person that you're going to help, or you take it yourself and, you know, paste it to them in an instant message session. Or even if you had to read it to them over the phone, they open it up in their browser. They're prompted through a couple of things to authorize you, and then you're good to go. It lets them in to the, it lets you into their computer, and now you can control things, but the person on the other end can see exactly what you're doing. You can even, talk to them and show them things. You could use it as training, or you can just simply fix things. And the person on the other end has a very comfortable big red button that they can push if, for whatever reason, they want the session to end. If you visit gotoassist.com/gab, that is gotoassist.com/gab, you get your first 30 days free of GoTo Assist Express from Citrix. So go ahead and check that out. gotoassist.com/gab. And that's that. John and Pete, I do want to revisit our previous topic, because I was trying to rack my brain for that term as you're getting too high in altitude and not enough speed to keep the plane going.
That's it. Embarrass me publicly here, Dave.
It is. I couldn't remember it. So as you guys were talking, I texted my brother, who is not a pilot, but I think would happily play one on TV if given the chance. And I knew he would know the answer, and he did. It's called the coffin corner. Had you ever heard that phrase before?
I haven't.
Okay.
No. Oh, interesting. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So but, as you've got too much altitude to hold the altitude, you know, your lift and your thrust are such that, right, you're going down.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well,
and what we have on the MD-11, we have a max Mach speed, and mm-hmm. it's a red line, and it that's a function of altitude and temperature and all,
sure,
that sort of thing.
Yep.
And how much Mach the airplane, it's obviously Mach limited to,
right,
to the actual structural Mach limit. And then underneath, as you go up higher, you have a bottom foot coming, riding up the tape going,
right,
this is your minimum speed. If you go any slower than this, you're going to fall out of the sky. And those 2 feet start to approach each other the higher you get. And if you get them closer than about 40 knots apart, you're living on the ragged edge up there. So
the funny thing is, and the reason this came into being was, I know we're just talking about asides here, but the very first time I had GoGo in-flight wireless, I got on Skype with my brother. Now, this was before they had policy-wise limited the ability to do that. Of course, there's no way to technically keep Skype from working because it just works. Right, John? As we found, hopefully. Mm-hmm. Are you still there?
Is it still working for you, John?
Absolutely.
Skype works. Okay. and so apparently he had been researching this particular topic all week because he obsesses about, you know, aviation. And so he asked me, he said, oh, you know, what flight are you on? And so I said, well, I told him, and he went on FlightAware and found it. And he said, gosh, he's like, What kind of plane is that? He said, is it whatever it was? It was a Virgin America flight. And I said, yeah, that's right. And he said, gosh, he said, based on the math I'm doing here, you're getting really, really close to the coffin corner. And we were cooking, but we were way up. I mean, I think we were over 40,000 feet, which is rare for a commercial flight. Rare. You know, I mean, it happens sometimes. The right conditions send you up there.
Yeah, the lighter you are, that sort of thing. Yeah. I mean, sometimes you're just too heavy to get up there.
I got it. Okay. And, but he was very excited. He's like, oh, this is great. He says, you're really, really close. And I had another pilot who follows me on Twitter. I tweeted, I said, well, this is great. You know, I'm on a plane and learning about this thing called the coffin. What is it? What did I say it was?
The coffin corner.
Yeah. Nice. And you know, this is not the right place to learn about it. And I sent out my flight aware thing, and this other pilot said, yeah, well, you know, you're not as close as you might think. He said, but you are closer than most commercial airliners get. So whatever. Yeah. Anyway,
in closing, Dave, I got to say, you were speaking about playing a pilot. I think you guys would agree. If you could join me in a moment of silence for who recently passed away, Peter Graves, AKA Captain Over.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
That's a great loss. Whether you liked Airplane or Mission Impossible, I think I liked him in both, actually. But
yeah. Yeah, two totally different characters, too.
Yeah, but I think almost every pilot I know really digs Airplane.
Oh, there's nothing funnier than walking into the crew room in the middle of the night and watching 75 commercial pilots sitting around watching Airplane.
That's funny. All right, so it's time to move on to Mark, which is a very interesting question, I think, John. Are we ready to move on? Ready to wrangle this one back under control?
Hey, guys, this is Mark from Buffalo. I just had a technical...
I'm going to stop here. Mark's audio clicks and pops are Mark's and Mark's alone, so we will play through this with them, at least to the point where we get his message through.
Cool question regarding my SuperDrive and my MacBook Pro. What's happening is the disk doesn't seem to be able to be read. So, you know, I can put in like my new version of 2009 iWork, and it'll spin, and you can hear it spinning in kind of a weird way, and then it'll kick out. And it happens with all disks. I have a Microsoft Word disk. The same thing happened. And so I took it into the Genius Bar. And they basically hooked up a drive to it and booted from their drive, which had supposedly a clean operating system on it. And they threw in their own DVD. This was not a DVD program, but a DVD movie. And the movie started up and worked fine. So the conclusion that they drew was that I needed to make a clean boot of my operating system. So I nuke and paved, as you guys say, and put a disc in as soon as I nuked and paved. Now, interestingly, the install disc, I believe, worked fine. But after I nuke and paved, I put a couple of the same discs in and had the same problem. These discs are brand, well, the iWork disc, at least, is brand new and not scratched up. The other disc is in pretty good condition and not scratched up. So it doesn't appear that the clean install solved the problem.
All right, we'll stop the comment there. I think we've got the gist of the input, John.
One thing that comes to my mind now that I listen to this again, why didn't they try that disc in his computer?
I have no idea. It doesn't make any sense.
To me, that would have been a nice way to compare apples to apples. Okay, external drive reading a movie works fine. Internal drive reading a movie works fine or doesn't work fine. To me, that would have been a useful nugget.
Well, that's what they did do. They booted his machine.
Well, I think he booted from... I don't believe he said they booted from...
Mode or something?
Yeah.
I don't believe they booted from his drive on...
No.
The DVD.
No, they booted from one of their discs on the DVD, but then used his drive to play a movie, which, okay, that's fine. But playing a movie is very different from playing, you know, from reading other data from that drive. I don't know. It seems weird to me.
Okay. I don't know if there were enough data points here, but my guess is going to be, I mean, especially since he installed the new OS, and you know, I always love living hardware since I'm software type of guy or like to be. I would guess that his internal drive is kind of on the blink.
I would agree.
That it may be. I've had cases where I'm not able sometimes, and I haven't tried this in a while. I don't burn a lot of DVDs. I think you burn more than I do, Dave. But I've had cases where even though my drive, and if you go to System Profiler and you look at the drive will advertise the CD and DVD formats that it should be able to handle.
Right.
And even when I've seen one listed, now it could be conflicting with Toast or whatever other sort of CD software or DVD software I have in the machine. But I've had cases where it absolutely said, I understand DVD dash or minus RW dual layer, and I know that's what I put in there, and it still spits it out saying, I don't like your media, go away.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, I don't know. This is a weird one, but I think you're right. I think it's hardware. It's got to be. It's just weird that it was able to boot from his Mac OS X DVD and install an operating system from it. But then, you know, he couldn't read. The question mark would be, can you read that DVD once you're booted from the hard drive? Otherwise, I don't know. It's wacky.
The disk could be filthy. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Or the drive just filthy and it, I don't know. Yeah.
Dust or something on the lens. I don't think I've used a lens cleaner in ages, but in theory there could be, gunk on the lens.
Yeah.
I've seen this before. I think our buddy Paul Kent ran into this once. Sometimes the drive will complain that the laser's on the fritz, and if the laser is marginal or starting to fail, then you may be able to see this. And I hate these. We both hate these problems, Dave. These, things that are you can't always reproduce. That sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So,
I found when I was consulting John, as you said that, a warning light went off in my head. I did consulting for probably a decade, if not longer, and. So you learn some lessons along the way, and a very general lesson that I learned after many, many hours, and of course, many, many build hours, was that when you had something where it just wasn't making sense, you do this one time and it works, and then you do it another time and it doesn't work, and it's very wacky and unpredictable. As soon as it got to that point, my gut would roll over, and it's hardware. It's always hardware when it's wacky like that. Software, fault it all you want, but when you take the same path, and it has to be the same path with all the variables being equal, but when you take the same path through it, it acts the same way every single time. Now, sometimes it's not possible to control all the variables, and you get into a situation where you don't know, but with hardware, once you know you're controlling all the variables and it's just not being consistent, it's hardware. And that, I think that's our problem with Mark's question, John, is, as you said, we don't have enough data points to know, is it being consistent? Is it certain disks or is it only certain times or certain phases of the moon?
Altitude.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Power line noise.
Right, but if power line noise or altitude is causing an issue on this machine or any other machine, that's a hardware problem, right? I mean, if it's not causing it on other machines nearby, then that it's still a hardware problem. Again, it's just,
presumably it worked before this.
That is a presumption.
A new problem, yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Is it a new problem? Yes. That was always my other favorite question when I was consulting with people is, okay, what changed? And, all the time the answer was nothing.
Nothing.
Right, of course. That's right, folks. Uh-huh. Your computer just magically installed this software and broke itself. Is that right? Well.
I did add this and install that and Bonsai Buddy. But other than that, no, nothing's changed.
No, nothing's changed other than all that spyware I installed the other night when I was surfing all those different websites. Yeah. So we don't have enough information, Mark, but based on what we do have, it sounds like hardware. And it certainly was a fun conversation to have.
John, he could. I mean, I don't know if he wants to bring it to an Apple authorized service provider or maybe go back to the Apple store. But I'm just thinking, if he wants to go to there are certainly places that will sell him a new drive and also other people that would certainly be willing to install it. I don't know if he necessarily wants to go back to the Apple store to do that. But
if it's under warranty, he does.
Oh, well, in that case, okay. I
don't know
if it's under warranty.
Yeah, just speculating, but yeah.
Okay.
All right. You know, John, you've been using Mail App now for a couple of weeks, and I love this because you're finding things that only a new user that's using it freshly would look for, whereas those of us that have been using it for a long time have sort of learned to have sort of learned to deal with its quirks or its issues. But as I always say about Mail, the best part about it is its extensibility, the ability to install or use add-ons. And we mentioned one in this show already with DocStar, add-ons that either add functionality or enhance the built-in functionality. And that's really what makes Mail usable for me and kind of almost infinitely powerful, because the power is left up to third-party developers. So with that in mind, John, you found a solution to a problem some of us might not even realize we had.
Yes. This is something that you will run into. So here's my situation. I have an email address where I have things from other emails forwarded to.
So, okay. So you have one like catch-all bucket that that many other email addresses kind of funnel into. Is that right, John?
That's correct.
Okay.
And
that's
so
a smart thing to do. In
yes.
these days with IMAP accounts, you want one mail account that is yours, but you might have many addresses, personal address, work address, you know, other things that funnel into it. So I'm just trying to give this some context. Go ahead, John.
Yes. So, and what happens is Mail is certainly, so if I define the account for the primary ISP, and I also include, as we talked about, you can comma separate the other email addresses that correspond to that one primary one. Then Mail is smart enough. So if it's sent to, say, for example, like in my case, john@macobserver.com, that actually gets sent to another address. But what happens is Mail is smart enough, if I reply to it, to show that the my address to the person I'm replying to is john@macobserver.com. That's wonderful. Here was the aggravating part that I found with Mail. And this is where Eudora was able to let me do this without too much grief.
Right.
Mail, with its signature capability, is not smart enough to pick a signature based on the address that the mail appears to be coming from. So again, while it selects the correct address, so say somebody sends something to john@macobserver.com, when I reply to that person, it shows them that it is coming from john@macobserver.com, but it will not select my Mac Observer signature.
Okay. And just to be clear, where Mail does auto select signatures is if you have multiple accounts defined, full email accounts, and then you can assign default signatures to those accounts. But if you have multiple addresses inside one account, you're absolutely right. You cannot have different signatures for each of those addresses.
Correct.
Okay.
So what I found, and then to also kind of give a little background on how you set up signatures in Mail, there are two ways to do it. So there, when you go into the signature section, so you go into Mail, I think it's preferences, and then you get a whole bunch of things you can customize for Mail. And all the way on the far right, or it should be most next to rules, is signatures. And what you will see on the left side of your screen is a number of different categories. And here's and I want to give some background because this is how I solved the problem, but this is important to mention this. So one category is all signatures. Now, in this case, you could define a signature and not necessarily associate it with any particular account.
Yeah, and that can be confusing in and of itself.
Yes. In this case, it worked to my advantage because now also you can have, and then it will list. So there's an all signatures category. Then there are other categories that correspond to your email accounts.
Right.
So, you know, I have one for my .Mac, one for my Gmail, one for the account that you know, is kind of this catch-all for a number of my other emails.
Got it.
What I did is I found something called Signature Profiler. We will certainly link to it because I actually corresponded with the author because some of the behavior in it wasn't exactly intuitive to me, but I eventually figured out how to get it to do what I want. So what this will do for you is when you run Signature Profiler, and once you install it, it just appears in the preferences. So it's very transparent in how this appears, which is really nice to me.
Yep.
But then what I did is I go into this, and on the left side, it lists all of your email accounts. So it doesn't list the signature category. It just lists the email accounts.
Okay. Email accounts or email addresses?
Address. well, accounts.
Okay. Okay.
With which can have multiple addresses.
Correct. Okay. Correct. Yep.
So, for example, the one that I have that's a catch-all, it's listed here as, you know, what it is, and it says four email addresses. So I actually have it and three other addresses all come into it. Now, what happens is when you click on this using Signature Profiler, and this is kind of the trick here. So step one, when I click on that address, it will show the four other that address and three others that correspond to that account.
Yep.
And then you can use Signature Profiler to say, okay, for this address, choose, and now here it is that we get, this is where it got a little complex. So it says, choose a tail signature. And this is terminology that's specific to Signature Profiler, but it'll make sense in a moment. So what I did is basically associate each one of these, you know, with right. a signature. The thing is, the reason that I didn't include the signatures under the account in the mail signature thing is if they're already owned by an account, they will not appear in the menu. So that's caveat number
interesting.
One.
Interesting. Okay.
They just have to be, because at first when I ran this, I'm like, where are the signatures? I know they exist.
Right.
So this is just the logic that I think he used to develop this, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But then here was the second part. So then I wrote him and I said, well, I associated all these, but it's still not smart enough to bring up the signature. And here was the final step that I had to take. I went to signatures, went to all signatures, or I'm sorry, went to the account that I had all these other catch-alls with, and I defined something called tail signature. And then here's how he does what he does. And then within that, he actually allows you within certain parameters to include like little macros or little data definitions. So basically, I associated with that account tail signature, and then in the actual signature text I put left curly bracket tail dot signature right curly bracket. What that is a sign to Signature Profiler saying, okay, if you see this, then take whatever's defined in this other part as a tail signature and replace that.
Okay,
so what happens is when I reply, as soon as I hit reply, it
does its
instantly
logic.
Grabs this saying, oh, okay, I know which signature I'm going to use because Signature Profiler knows this, and let me fill in that text for you. So it doesn't put curly bracket tail dot signature right curly bracket.
Sure.
Puts in whatever I further define with Signature Profiler. So okay, I wrote the guy. He sent me to his blog. It helped me understand the logic of why things were happening that way. But the end result is when I reply, not only is the correct from address defined, but it picks the right signature.
Oh, so this is great.
I am now totally happy, and of course I'm going to link to this gentleman. It's Donationware. I'm going to throw him a few bucks just because this solved the one annoyance that I had, is that occasionally I wouldn't notice that my signature was wrong, and then people would get the mail and they'd be like, well, I see this in your signature, and then I see this in your from. Now usually right. they just apply the from, but I was just being OCD and it just bothered me.
Yeah,
I want my signature to match the account.
Well, that can especially matter between a work and a personal email, or you know, something like that, where that's huge. I've always wanted to do this, but again, you know, you get complacent. You know, I probably looked for a way to do this once many, many moons ago and didn't find it. And so now my workflow is just that I'm choosing signatures, you know, from the little drop down menu every time I create a message. And it's fine, but gee, it sure would be nice to have it auto chosen. I never bothered to check. Hey, did somebody write something since, you know, 7 years ago when I looked for this? So that's great. So my question is, if once you've created the message and then you choose it, so like for creating a new message, if you change your from address in the dropdown, does it then automatically change the signature to match? Like replying, I get that, but you know, with a new message, it's going to auto default to your main address, and then you know, you can choose another address from the dropdown.
I'm going to try it right now, but okay. I believe I tried this, and the answer is yes. So I'm going to click on my inbox for this catch-all account.
Yeah,
I'm going to say new message. It defaults to the primary address of that, okay. And the signature is called Tails Signature, as I mentioned, and it gets the one that I use.
Okay.
Now let me switch over to John Mac Observer, and voila, it just fills in the new one.
Oh,
so the answer
brilliant.
Is yes, in real time. So, Dave, I think you got to get in on this action.
Definitely.
To any listeners who get frustrated with signatures not matching or just don't want to click on the pull down. So,
that's great. Oh, that's awesome. Okay, cool. Thank you. That's great. That's I appreciate that. See, even we learn stuff from the show. We are getting to the point where we're running out of time, but I did want to offer a clarification. Our own John Martellaro, hi John, listened to the last show, and he said, "You know, I thought I heard you guys mention that there are no instructions for moving a current Time Machine archive to a larger drive." But there are, and I had just seen the Knowledge Base article on that subject a few days before. And he points us to Knowledge Base HT1427 with a section entitled How to Transfer Your Backups from Your Current Hard Drive to a New Hard Drive. And then there's a section below that that says how to transfer your backups from an existing time capsule to a new one. And there is it talks about doing it on the former, where you're doing just a hard drive to a hard drive. It tells you to mount both drives, and it's worth going through the instructions here because there are a couple of nuances, like making sure you turn off Time Machine before you start mucking about with this stuff. But dragging the backups.backupd folder from one hard drive to the other and then reselecting the disk. And then with a time capsule, you're actually creating new disk images on the new time capsule and partitioning them in different ways and then dragging the data around that way. So it's a somewhat convoluted process, especially on the time capsule, but there is an officially Apple sanctioned way of doing this, which is a good thing because it means that they will likely support you if you attempt this and have any problems. So thank you, Mr. Martellaro. And John, I think that's it. But you know what we have to do is we have to tell all our lovely listeners here how they can find us and how they can get in touch with us. Don't you think?
I think so. And you know, the first way that I would try to do this, Dave, is maybe not the first way, but one way is you could call us. You could pick up the phone or do a Skype call or whatever the heck you use for a phone these days. Like an iPhone. And you could call 206-666-GEEK. And Dave, that is
4335. That's right. And you can also email us. There are two email addresses to use. One is feedback@macgeekgab.com. And yes, John, I said feedback@macgeekgab.com.
I thought you said feedback@macgeekgab.com, but I didn't want to interrupt and say... Did you say feedback@macgeekgab.com, Dave? Which is the first address. And of course, the second address is premium.
That's right. Premium@macgeekgab.com. For those of you that are subscribers to our premium edition, and we certainly appreciate that. And that helps us kind of keep things separated out. And you mentioned Skype before, John, and you certainly could call the number with Skype. But you can also simply call MacGeekGab on Skype, and that will get your voicemail to exactly the same place, albeit with lesser quality, because Skype's gateway, although I guess it'd be the same quality if you're going from Skype to Skype. Skype's outbound plain old telephone system gateway has horrible quality, but it works. And obviously it's enough to for us to hear it on the show and for it to be intelligible for the listeners. So if that's your preferred path, please feel free to take it. The best quality audio we get is from those of you that record on your Macs or on your iPhones and email the audio to us at feedback@macgeekgab.com or premium@macgeekgab.com. And that's it. We're ready to head out of here, right, John?
And I think I found this, though. The iPod Touch also supports recording, but you know, I am at a loss here, Dave. I would think in my big mountain of swag here that I would have at least one device that does audio input and earphones, because I think it's a special connector, at least on the iPod Touch. I think it's a four-conductor connector.
Yeah.
I don't seem to have anything, so I'll have to pick that up, because, yeah, at this point, the VU meter shows up, but it doesn't hear me. Maybe that'll come in the next Touch. It'll have a built-in microphone.
And Pete's saying a Bluetooth headset, the Touch support Bluetooth?
Oh.
Does it support
Thank
Bluetooth?
Thank you, Pete.
There you go, man. Yeah.
Mine does. Yeah, okay. Mine has the Bluetooth enabled. Look at that. I can use. Wow.
See, having me around is a good thing now and then, guys.
I have buried somewhere a Bluetooth headset.
All right. See,
I wonder if I can marry my Mac to it.
Your Mac to a Bluetooth headset, and you can use it for Skype. I was using that for a while, and it's handy because I can walk around the office and have Skype calls.
All right.
So, See, the tips just keep flowing. We can't help ourselves here, folks. This Week in iPhone is the podcast that our friend Mr. Michael Johnston runs. He's the one that converts the show to AAC for us and for you. Cashfly hosting at CACHEFLY.com provides all the bandwidth. The podcast marketplace includes the A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, as we mentioned, Yojimbo from Barebones Software, PDF Pen from Smile on My Mac, and also the new Text Expander 3 from Smile on My Mac, Notebook from Circus Ponies, and GoToAssist.com/Gab for GoToAssist Express from Citrix. The one thing we didn't go through, John, you got to remind me to talk about it in the next show, is I saw a movie. It was a documentary about Richard Garriott, a.k.a. Lord British, the creator of all the Ultima games. Yeah. And it was one of the coolest movies I've ever seen. And so I definitely want, it's a geeky enough thing that it makes perfect sense for us to talk about here. So I want to make sure we talk about that in the next show. So remind me, it's on my list. I didn't even remember. So, but we're out of here now.
That's dude, that. I remember I stayed up for days when I was a wee geek. I would stay up for days literally with no sleep playing Ultima. It was terrible.
Yeah, it was great, wasn't it?
And Wizardry, that was the other one.
Right. That's right. That was the competing product, I guess. Yeah. Yeah. Just make sure if you're going to stay up for days and play games that, you know, you don't get caught.
Maynard.